Is it time for a mind shift? If you don't know what that means, then join your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, a former evangelical Christian pastor and Bible college teacher of over 20 years, along the journey of deconstruction and reconstruction of faith, life, religion, and spirituality.
If anyone's been listening to my podcast for the last several months, you'll know that I've been doing a tremendous amount of talking, reading, writing, research on this area of Christian Reconstructionism, Dominion Theology, Christian Nationalism. So in that vein, I am super happy to welcome Sam Perry, sociologist and author of the book, along with Andrew Whitehead, Taking America Back for God, Christian Nationalism in the United States. So thank you, Sam, for taking some time out of your schedule to talk to me.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. This is going to be fun.
This is going to be really fun. I know we were talking a little bit before we hit record. We have some areas of commonality as far as our theological background and biblical studies and all that. I'm fascinated by the theological roots of American nationalism, Christian nationalism, but you guys came at it from more of a sociological perspective from what I've been reading so far. What actually led you to research and write about this particular topic?
Yeah, I think about 5 or 6 years ago, my co-author, Dr. Whitehead, and I really started to get into this idea. We were fascinated by the Tea Party and kind of this resurgence of what we felt like was kind of a, I don't know if we would call it full-on dominionism, but we were fascinated by that idea of this narrative of Christian nation. And we started to play around with some data, and we started to notice that it seemed to be very strongly correlated with wanting to draw very, very clear racial boundaries. And we were curious about that. Like we were messing around with some data that we happened to have on hand, and we were throwing together some measures, and we were thinking about, okay, what is this idea of, what is it belief about a Christian nation and this narrative of the United States has a special relationship with God, and we should take that back, and we should protect that and defend our Christian heritage, those kinds of narratives. And so we started to put together some measures. And the first thing we started to notice was that people who subscribe to this ideology seem to draw very, very rigid boundaries around what it means to be an American. And those tend to be very like racialized boundaries. Mm-hmm. And so they very much against immigration of any kind, very suspicious of outsiders, religious outsiders, and especially Muslims, who they would consider to be kind of anti everything that it is to be an American. But even beyond that, they seem to be antagonistic toward any kind of racial boundary crossing in any context. So for example, one of the first papers we wrote on this, or the first couple of papers, had to do with Christian nationalism and how people who subscribed to that ideology were very much against interracial marriage and against transracial adoption. And so those two ideas, it seems curious, like what, you know,
what's
this political theology, what would be your beef with interracial marriage or transracial adoption? And yet it was one of the strongest predictors that somebody had a problem with it. And so we started to develop theories of what's going on here, and what are the components of this ideology, and what does it point to? Is it something that is akin to right-wing authoritarianism? Is that what we're measuring? Or is it something like biblical literalism, just a little bit kind of thicker or a bit more intricate? And we found that it's actually different from all of those things. It's a political theology. It's an ideology that seeks to merge a certain kind of Christian identity with American civic belonging. And when I say Christian, I need to put that in quotes, because that term Christian is freighted with a lot of cultural baggage. It doesn't just mean Orthodox creeds or subscribing to, you know, being born again. It means far more than that. It means it's more like a political dog whistle. So if somebody who is kind of high on Christian nationalism that we have been measuring, if some of this subscribes to this ideology, when they say Christian, it's more like a dog whistle. It means people like us. It means white, native born, conservative, culturally Christian at the very least, or at least for the kinds of things that Christians are for, values wise and family wise and social order. And so whoever seeks to kind of merge that kind of Christian identity with American civic life and civic belonging, I think we would put in the camp of Christian nationalists. So to go back to your original question, I think we have, we initially, it started with just kind of playing around with some data and asking some questions. And then this whole project really unfolded from there.
I came across your article in the Sociology of Religion journal 2018. So you've been working on this for at least a couple, two, 3 years, you and Andrew. It seems like one of the things that jumped out was that you cite the Baylor Survey of Religion, one of the more recent Baylor Surveys of Religion, and you base a lot of your sociological data off that. I mean, is that what makes your book sort of unique as compared to other books on Christian nationalism? For example, I just spoke with Catherine Stewart, who's the author of The Power Worshippers, and it's more anecdotal and research-based as far as trying to find groups and making connections with these Christian right organizations, Christian nationalist organizations. What is it that makes your book different?
Yeah, that's a great question. So first, Catherine Stewart's book is fantastic, and I recommend anybody getting a hold of it. I would say her book is along the lines in kind of the heritage of other books that have been written by journalists like American Fascist by Chris Hedges and Michelle Goldberg's Kingdom Coming, the Rise of Christian Nationalism back in the mid-2000s. And so I think journalists have been really tackling this subject of Christian dominionism and Christian nationalism. What we wanted to do is our unique contribution as sociologists and empirical sociologists was let's describe this thing with some data. Like what exactly are we looking at and what exactly are we talking about? Because oftentimes without some concrete data to really support a lot of the claims that we're making, we end up kind of working with really fuzzy concepts. Like what exactly does it mean to be a Christian nationalist? And how many Christian nationalists are there? I mean, can we quantify that at all? Is that a large percentage of the population or is it this really small kind of powerful group? And so what we wanted to do, and you mentioned the Baylor Religion Survey, and one of the things that has been encouraging to us is we've collected lots of survey data since 2007 is when we first started kind of noticing we had some data on this. And then 2017, we've used the General Social Survey and even subsequent surveys since then. And we continue to find the exact same thing in survey after survey. As long as we're using the measures that we're using, we find Christian nationalists, people who score higher on our little scale of Christian nationalism they draw those racial boundaries. They tend to be very authoritarian. They tend to be into traditional gender roles. They will unapologetically vote Trump. They deny climate change. I mean, they are suspicious of science. I mean, all of these things down the list. As long as we have our measures in there, we keep on finding the same thing.
The statistics are consistent survey after survey.
Consistent.
Right. Right. Yeah, so it's not an anomaly or a blip
right.
on the radar
screen.
Right.
It wasn't something unique about that survey. It's wherever we happen to field a survey, we find the same thing. To reiterate, I think our unique contribution to this and what we were trying to do with the book is to say, let's describe this phenomenon. One of the things that sociologists ideally we hope to do is to explain the world, we have to describe it. And to describe it, we have to measure it. So we want to measure it. We want to describe what's actually going on and then put theory behind that to try to explain, okay, here's why we think this is happening now. Here's what we think it's connected to and what's driving it. And here are the consequences of it long term. And so I think we're uniquely suited to do that because of our kind of data collection and data analysis bent.
And that's what you do as sociologists. How do you define Christian nationalism? Because, of course, there's different definitions that float around. I've talked to Andrew Seidel from the Freedom From Religion Foundation, and he's written a book about the myth of Christian America and all that. Yeah. And so he's got a particular definition. Catherine Stewart's got a definition. Other people have a different definition. There seems to be, in your writing, a connection between the myth of the sort of American Christian story. Would you put that all together?
Yeah, I think that's a part of it. I wouldn't say that completely encapsulates it. Like, I think you can think the United States was founded as a Christian nation and not necessarily be a Christian nationalist if you're just thinking that's like a historical fact. Mm-hmm. So certainly Christian nationalists would subscribe to that narrative of the United States has been and should always be distinctively Christian. Mm-hmm. But I think it means more than that. I think it's more akin to that definition I provided a little while ago of somebody. Christian nationalism is an ideology or a cultural framework that idealizes and advocates a fusion of Christian with American civic belonging and identity. Mm-hmm. And so it's not strict theocracy. I mean, if we can get into some terms and why I think Christian nationalism is a little bit different. I don't think it's theocracy, because I think theocracy is, as I understand it, is the idea that we want, or a theonomy even, the idea that the Bible should be the law of the land, or theocracy, that like there should be some kind of clergy or religious leader that is also leading the nation. Mm-hmm. Christian nationalists, we have found, are actually pretty okay with like Donald Trump leading the United States, and he's demonstrably not a pious person, certainly nothing close to clergy or a religious leader. Mm-hmm. And Christian nationalists, actually, I think what makes them different from, I think, a lot of Christian theocrats or somebody who would say, hey, let's break this down completely and reconstruct it from the bottom up, from the Bible forward, is Christian nationalists really sanctify the American founding documents. It's a merging of the two. It's mm-hmm. it's not just, hey, the Bible ought to lead the United States. It's that the Bible did lead the United States, and so our founding documents are sacred. They are divinely inspired, even. Mm-hmm. Even though the Constitution itself is godless, the Bill of Rights, though, I mean, we hold these truths to be self-evident and that kind mm-hmm. of thing. And so you've got claims that a couple of examples of this, Robert Jeffers, who's a famous pastor and kind of a court evangelical mm-hmm. of Donald Trump, and another guy named Rafael Cruz, who's the father mm-hmm. of Ted Cruz, Senator Ted Cruz. Both of them, we have quotes from them in the book really talking about how the founding documents of the founding fathers, Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, were divinely given mm-hmm. by God and written by God-loving, freedom-loving men who want to, you know, lead the country to like worship mm-hmm. the true God. And so, I mean, I think that would make it so that idea of an ideology that wants to merge and sees a wedding of Christian identity and American identity together, not necessarily where one dominates the other, but they see the two as coterminous, mm. if that makes sense.
It's a merger, isn't it, of the sort of right. American life plus this religious aspect. Well, right. I was reading your Washington Post article from a couple of years ago where you talked about some of the research that eventually wound its way into your book, and you make the point in the article that, and in the book as well, that it's not necessarily about the religious tenets, you say, what is behind their support for Trump, for example. You say it's Christian nationalism. The larger the extent that they believe that America is a Christian nation, the more likely someone is to vote for Trump. So, right. But of course, to go along with that, as you say, there's Islamophobia, xenophobia, anti-immigrants, racism, sexism. There's some pretty disturbing trends in these Trump supporters.
Yeah, and you know, I think one of the things that we've spoken around the country, really talking about our findings, and as we've tried to get the word out, one of the things that we want to emphasize about our findings is in people who might be skeptical, Christian, devout Christians who are kind of like, well, are you talking about me? I mean, I want to advocate Christian values, and I think I should vote my conscience. And we're mm-hmm. not necessarily talking about that group. You know, we're talking about a group of people that when you get down to it, and this is one of the things I feel like the data portion of our analysis is so important. This whole ideology of Christian nationalism really is associated with some very, very ugly trends mm-hmm. and some ideas. I mean, some very, like, not just xenophobic, I mean, phobic in the worst sense, like mm-hmm. irrational fear of immigrants, like not just, hey, we ought to think intelligently about immigration. It is, immigrants want to ruin my country and hurt me. Muslims want to commit acts of terrorism and hurt mm. me. Atheists, Jews, like it's the other, anybody besides kind of the us in that group. Mm. There's all kinds of irrational fears that go along with this. To skeptical of African Americans and inequality related to African Americans, believing more likely to believe that illegal or undocumented immigrants coming across the border are dangerous criminals. And so it's not just like we're trying to say, hey, we don't like Trump and this ideology leads to Trump support. It's like, mm-hmm. no, this ideology leads to all of the other ugly things that are also associated with Trump support.
Exactly.
But the other thing I'll also want to emphasize is, as we're trying to explain this to people, we find that once we account for Christian nationalism in our multivariate models, we find that once the people who are more religiously committed, once we account for Christian nationalism, being more religiously committed actually goes in the opposite direction. And this was fascinating to me. So Christian nationalism seems to make you more xenophobic, more Islamophobic, more racist. But once we account for Christian nationalism, being more religious, like reading your sacred text more, praying more, going to church more, it makes you less xenophobic, less Islamophobic, and less racist. And so it's this kind of weird paradox of, once we account for this Christian nationalist ideology, what you have left is you have, I would consider, truly devout people who have internalized, hopefully, the teachings of their mm-hmm. religious faith about tolerance and love and acceptance and mercy and kindness. And so we actually find that, you know, religiosity can in some ways be very, very pro-social once we remove the effects of Christian nationalism, if mm-hmm. that makes sense.
And there is a segment, I have to be fair, there are a segment of Christians and evangelicals who oppose Trump, who are yeah. vocal about speaking out against what they see in evangelicalism, for example. I was just reading today an article in Christianity Today yeah. about a guy that they were interviewing. He's an evangelical leader. He's been very vocal against what he sees in the church and the support for Trump. And he said one of the things that stuck out in the article was he said the unbelievable amounts of cruelty that he and his family have been subjected to by other Christians because of his stance. Right. You know, and people have lost their jobs, people in Bible colleges and seminaries and pastors. And, you know, it's so there's some really, as you say, some very ugly sides to this thing. And you think, what does this have to do with supposedly the teachings of Christ and loving one another? And right. all that's gone out the window.
Yeah.
In favor of what?
And I think that is really, I think evangelicalism, and I was talking about this the other day with an academic friend of mine, Philip Gorski at Yale, who has written a great book called American Covenant. Mm. And it's a kind of a comparative historical work of sociology on civil religion. And he talks about Christian nationalism as well. And I really do think that in some ways, evangelicalism is being hollowed out mm-hmm. in a really tragic way by this whole, either it's being revealed for what it always was, and maybe that's the case, or it's being, whatever it was, it's being exacerbated and kind of gutted by this unapologetic Trump support.
It's true.
And I think in some ways, you know, fracturing, maybe for the best, along the lines of race, gender, egalitarianism, social justice, and Trump support is part and parcel with all of those things.
You make the point in your book and your articles too that a lot of people were shocked in 2016 at this the famous 81%.
81%, yeah.
The 81% evangelical vote for Trump, and then of course in the last 3 years the consistent support for him by evangelical leaders and lay people alike. But how far back does this movement go? Because it's not a blip on the radar screen, as we've said. It didn't just occur in 2016. You can point to people like David Barton of Wall Builders. He's famous for going all around the country promulgating this myth of Christian nationalism.
For decades.
Yeah, he's been doing it for a long time. You can go further back than that. You can go to R.J. Rush Dooney and people like him, Christian Reconstructionism. But I've even found sermons by Billy Graham in 1952, where he was talking about America's unique Christian background and history, and essentially this myth has been around for decades. Does it go even further back than that? How far back does this thing go?
Right. Great question. So I don't think it reflects the historical kind of narrative or the one that I understand from reading evangelical scholars like Thomas Kidd, who was a historian at Baylor, who is himself an evangelical and writes about the religious legacies and religious history of the United States. I don't think he would identify this kind of strain of Christian nationalism as around the time of the founding fathers. I think the founding fathers were aware of and friendly towards religion, but in so much as it kind of was wedded with like civic republicanism, they thought like being religious was the same thing as kind of being virtuous and being reliable and trustworthy. And so democracy needs people who are virtuous in order to survive. And I think that's what they kind of saw the usefulness of it as.
More of a civic religion sort of thing.
Yeah, civil religion. That was absolutely. Yeah. So in the early decades of the 1800s, you have, as the nation is trying to carve out its own unique identity, who are we as Americans? You start to see an emerging Christian nationalist narrative that is also connected to, I think, white privilege and all of those things together. So you've got historians that are talking about that in the early 1800s. Now, fast forward a century, and I think you see this, and Kevin Cruz has talked about this with his book, One Nation Under God. A lot of people don't know, like, this phrase, One Nation Under God, it started to get, you know, put in the pledge and on coins and all that stuff, and after World War II, right? So, like, we start to carve out this kind of Christian nation narrative, and we start to double down on it. And it had always been around, but we start to double down on this to separate us from the godless communists. So we're you know, the commies and the socialists want to make us atheists and make us a secular nation, but mm-hmm. no, we're a nation that's into free markets, we're into capitalism, and we're into Christianity, and all of those things are kind of wedded together. And that's where kind of Billy Graham was tied into that as well. Dwight D. Eisenhower. Yeah.
He was staunchly anti-communist, Billy Graham. That was one of his big planks. In fact, that sermon that I was talking about was delivered on the Capitol steps in 1952. Right. It's on his Billy Graham Evangelistic Association website. It's about 10 minutes long. Quite interesting.
So Kevin Cruz in One Nation Under God goes into all of that kind of story. But, mm-hmm. I mean, if you fast forward a little bit, so you mentioned Rush Dooney, and you've got the early kind of Reconstruction Dominionists. I think what separates them from the more recent iteration, and I think we have some data to back this up, is they were more post-millennial, right? Like they really thought, hey, we need to establish Christ's kingdom on earth and make sure that that happens here. And here's how we're going to do it. We're going to the Seven Mountains theology, and we're going to kind of, you know, take control of all these institutions. Mm. And there's some of that has bled over, but and you had Schaefer. Francis Schaefer and that crowd. Mm-hmm. But with folks like Falwell and the religious right, so you have folks like Falwell, you have folks like Pat Robertson, I think David Jeremiah, D. James Kennedy, mm-hmm. leading into folks like David Barton, and then you've got even all the way today, Tony Perkins and Robert Jeffress and these authors. They're all premillennial. They're all, you know, they think the world's going to hell in a handbasket. And what we can do is we can delay God's wrath by redeeming the country and by staving off wickedness. We can only do it for so long, but if we can do it as long as possible, then we can stave off God's wrath so that we can win people to Christ and so that we can do evangelism. Now, that's what they say theologically. I highly doubt Robert Jeffress is really, you know, lying awake at night thinking about God's wrath coming on the United States. And if we can only save a few more. I think it kind of comes from the same place, this wedding to power and not wanting to give it up.
Exactly.
But you do see, I think, a theological transition from like a post-millennial Reconstructionist kind of approach of Rush Dooney all the way to this premillennial redemptive and staving off God's wrath kind of thing. And if you ever read Falwell, like Listen America is his famous book where he's kind of talking about the warning signs and what's the wrath that's going to come upon the United States if we don't do something soon. It's that kind of narrative, like God's wrath is coming. And so we're not trying to conquer America as much as we're trying to hold off God's wrath from being dropped upon us, for being decadent.
Just taking a short break here in my conversation with Sam Perry. I hope you're enjoying this. I hope that you're getting a lot out of his approach, him and Andrew Whitehead's approach to this topic of Christian nationalism, coming at it from a sociological point of view, and we're going to get back to it in just a minute. I wanted to let you know what's coming up in the next few episodes here on Mindshift Podcast. The next episode that's going to drop is going to be a conversation that I had with Conway and Siegelman. They were on the show last year. They, of course, are the authors of the great books Holy Terror and Snapping, and we're going to use their models that they developed in those books, and we're going to apply them to what's going on, especially in the Trump administration, around the coronavirus, how he's handling this, and how Christian nationalists have been using what he's doing. And there's quite a lot of disturbing stuff that they've identified, so I think you're really going to want to catch that episode with Conway and Siegelman. And then the week after that, or 2 weeks, I should say, after that, I've got an episode with David from the Graceful Atheist podcast. I was just on his show, and we discovered that we're such kindred spirits. We have a real similar approach to talking to people and talking about topics, especially around this issue of deconstructing your former religious beliefs and deconverting, and what you do after that. How do you reconstruct? And so look for David from the Graceful Atheist podcast coming out after the one with Conway and Siegelman. And then tonight, as I'm doing this recording, I'm going to be talking to another former evangelical pastor like myself. I'm going to be talking to John Loftus. And of course, John Loftus is the author of the book, Why I Became an Atheist, A Former Preacher Rejects Christianity, as well as The Case Against Miracles, Christian Delusion, Why Faith Fails, and so many other ones. So I'm really looking forward to hearing John's story. And so that'll be coming out after the one with David. So again, we've got great content, just fantastic guests that I've been able to have on this show. So next week we've got Conway and Siegelman, then David from The Graceful Atheist, followed by John Loftus, and I'll probably be talking to some other people in between there and then. So there's some great stuff heading your way. I was going to say, too, that we are doing our Mindshift podcast Zoom call. I'm hoping to have Conway and Siegelman come back in maybe June or July. We had one last month with Stephanie McCown. She was on the show not too long ago. It was absolutely fantastic. And in fact, if you want to see that call and get an inside track as to what we talk about on those calls once a month, you can catch it on the Mindshift Podcast Facebook page. So head on over there. While you're there, go ahead and like the page if you would. And finally, I'll just say that if you believe in the work of what I'm doing, as far as getting the word out on Christian nationalism, Christian reconstructionism, all these things that are going on in certainly American politics, but even the world, I would say, you can support this show on Patreon. That would be greatly appreciated. The links to that are in the show notes. So if you're interested in that, go ahead and click on the Patreon link and see what this is all about. So let's go on and get back into the chat with Sam Perry as we take a look at this issue of taking America back for God and the rise of Christian nationalism. Well, even now we're seeing it with the coronavirus. I just wrote an article about various Christian responses to the coronavirus. Absolutely fascinating. And there's so much stuff I could have put in the article. I had to cut it off because it was getting too long anyway. But God's judgment aspect of the coronavirus, that's a big theme. And you come across that, what was the guy's name? The 700 Club guy.
Pat Robertson, yeah.
Pat Robertson, he just said the other day, yeah, that we are basically suffering this coronavirus because we as a species, humanity, has violated God's covenant. So there's that covenant theology. And that goes back, as you say, all the way back to certainly the Puritans. Sure. You know, you could point to that and say, okay, these guys came across to America seeing it as the new Israel. They were the new Israel inhabiting the promised land.
Right.
You know, and they had a covenant with God. And it was just as conditional as the covenant with that God had with Israel in the Old Testament. And so this whole thing has been framed, hasn't it? Every time there's any sort of natural disaster or this coronavirus, it's somehow interpreted as the judgment of God. Or it's a warning shot over the bows trying to get our attention so that we'll repent and come back to him. And you hear that theme repeated. Surely that must tie into all this theme of Christian nationalism on some level.
Right. So, and I do think there's a great point you made about Christian nationalism is very much of the theological tradition of connecting America's future and past with Israel, that we are the city on a hill, that we are promised blessings for obeying God and being a righteous and just nation. We're promised curses if we turn away from him.
Mm-hmm.
And so you do see some of that with the Puritans, obviously, a very, very much kind of controlling the politics of the day. I mean, certainly, you know, like there was no separation of church and state in the Massachusetts Bay Colony. It was, you know, theocratic in that way. But at the same time, you do see some other shifts in the interpretation of, so right now we're working on a lot of projects that really explores how historically disadvantaged minority groups interpret Christian nationalism, because they do it in a fundamentally different way than white Americans do. Mm-hmm. So with white Americans, we really see this kind of Christian nationalism is strongly connected to authoritarianism, of the desire to discipline and punish wrongdoers, to cast out outsiders and to keep them out and that kind of thing, and to vote for strongmen politicians who will promise to do that. Mm-hmm. But when you look at how the same ideology, when you look at how that plays itself out among, say, African Americans or among Latinos, we see a different story. So like African Americans mm-hmm. who hold to Christian nationalist beliefs are more likely to value things like racial diversity and pluralism. They're more likely to explain racial inequality in terms of structural inequality rather than like the moral failings of the poor people themselves, you know? And so with that, I think you see different drawing on theological narratives of our national kind of political theology or our national story. So African Americans historically, I'll just give them as an example, in the Black church, certainly you have a connection between the people of Israel and the church, but it's about, they would be more fans of the minor prophets of let yeah. justice roll like a river and righteousness like an ever flowing stream, right? Mm-hmm. Like that God will condemn those who oppress the innocent mm-hmm. and oppress the poor. and he will raise up the humble.
Mm-hmm.
Versus
liberation theology.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely. What you're talking about, that finds its roots in South America and among, yeah, right. Exactly. African-American, Hispanic communities who have been oppressed. They're saying, yes, God's on our side,
right?
The side of the right. poor and the oppressed. That's a completely different reading than the white nationalists who are in power right now.
Yeah. And so white Americans, especially like those who subscribe to Christian nationalism, are more likely to say, no, this is ours, right? Like they're more likely to spin a narrative that justifies their own privilege. And so, and the Old Testament passages they would draw on would be the ones about Israel maintaining cultural and blood purity, justifying the divine conquest, blessings and curses for moral righteousness rather than say like how you treat people. But it's more like, are you sexually pure? Are you undefiled? Are you mixing cultures and that kind of thing? And so you see a different kind of picking and choosing of which Old Testament narratives that you feel like fit the political theology that either justifies or raises up your own kind of group.
Mm-hmm. And what's interesting, too, is that you see these white Christian nationalists, they know that they've got to mobilize the African-American evangelical and Hispanic evangelical base. That's what they're working on right now. And yet, where does that fit in? Because as you say, that theology is completely different. It doesn't work. There was the rally just in, I think it was January, at a big Latino megachurch in Miami, Maldonado. And that was a fascinating thing because you had all these white nationalist leaders coming in and they're trying to get these Hispanics on board to vote for Trump in 2020. And yet, it just doesn't quite fit.
Yeah.
But yet, these guys are embracing, some of them are embracing some of the narrative, weirdly.
Yeah, that's right. So that specific, the Evangelicals for Trump rally in January, you have got to, and I try to quote this, I try to share that with anybody who listens. Trump, his Christian nationalist rhetoric is starting to develop more fully as he started to lean on his speechwriters more. Like, I mean, Trump famously was just horrible at like the making references to the Bible or speaking in the Christian language. I mean, the famous like two Corinthians. Yeah. You know, like everybody knows that.
Clearly a Bible scholar.
Yeah. He just came across like such a goof every time he tried to do it. But now
he said, I don't need to ask for forgiveness. What do I, I've never prayed for forgiveness.
The language. Right?
I know he doesn't even.
But now as he started to lean on his speechwriters more, I mean, listen to him at the Evangelicals for Trump rally, his speech, read that, download it. And it's amazing how explicit he's starting to get. Like, we in America, we're the land of freedom loving, God loving patriots. And those godless socialists want to come and take your rights to worship, you know, like it, it's starting to get very, very explicit. My guess is he's only going to double down on it more and more.
Absolutely. He knows it works. Well, one of the first things he said upon taking office was he was going to repeal the Johnson Amendment.
Right.
That was one of the things. And he said, addressing Christian evangelical audiences, I know your faith has been our faith. He's saying now it's my faith too. It's been under attack. And he's going down that line. Yes, you've been persecuted. That's going to end now. We're going to stop all that. We're going to guarantee religious liberty, blah, blah, blah. And man, does it, that red meat to the base, just, it's so effective.
Right.
And he knows it.
Even if he never follows through on it, that kind of signaling says, okay, this guy is communicating that he's on our side. And throughout, you know, the way he behaves on Twitter or in front of everybody, he gives off this persona of, I don't take crap from anybody. And so there's a hope that like Trump will go to fight for us and he'll be a president who fights for religious liberty and all the things that is code word or code language for.
It is.
But it's like Tony Perkins, president of the Family Research Council, said it best. He was just justifying why does Trump get a mulligan on sleeping with Stormy Daniels and sleeping with a porn star thing. And Tony Perkins says he gets a mulligan because, you know, evangelicals were sick of Barack Obama and all his leftists getting bullied by Barack Obama and his leftists. And Trump was that guy who was willing to finally punch the bully. And that's exactly what they think of Trump is he's the bully who punches the bully who you think is picking on you. And that's, you know, you just unleash him at the enemy.
Lance Wallnau, he's a famous Seven Mountains Dominion guy. Okay. He's taught Bible studies in the Congress and the White House and all that as well. And he's written a book, God's Chaos Candidate. And he's one of the guys that goes around referring to Trump as the Cyrus figure who is leading us out of the 8 years of Obama captivity. So that's the narrative. You know, he's God's appointed man. He's draining the swamp, and he's politically incorrect. And like you said, so that excuses so much of his bad behavior because he's getting stuff done for us. He's advancing our agenda.
Yeah.
It's amazing. I don't know if you came across, there was that big flap in December where the guy from, I think it was Christianity Today, one of the editors.
Mark Galley.
Yes, he wrote this article. Man, it was a firestorm. But then there was a response. I don't know if you saw the open letter response.
Is that Grudem? Wayne Grudem? Or yeah.
No, this was about 200 or so signatories. It was an open letter response. Right. What was fascinating to me was the people who were saying, hey, you don't represent us. We're going to speak for ourselves. The Trump supporters, I went down the list and you look at the names, you know, Dominionists, Reconstructionists, Seven Mountains guys, famous people, Tony Perkins, guys like that are saying, hey, we disagree with your letter. And their point was Trump's doing everything that he promised. He's appointing judges, conservative judges. He's guaranteeing family rights, family values, all the loaded language, as you say, religious liberty, blah, blah, blah. So from their point of view, he's winning and we're winning as Christians. Right. Happy days.
Yeah, that's right. I think that kind of speaks to the Christian nationalist kind of ideology defines winning as power. And this is where Catherine Stewart's, I love her title and I'm so jealous, honestly, like it's such a,
you
it's
wanted
such a great
it.
title. It's a fantastic book, but The Power Worshippers, I mean, really sums it up so well. I mean,
it's very poignant.
Winning for a Christian nationalist is cultural and political influence and power. It's not about, if it's more people coming to Christ, it's more people coming to our team. That's the goal, right? And so it's not like, but even if it's not, right? Like it's still like, we would rather risk all of that for the sake of making sure that the influence that we hold on the nation's values and direction is what it is. And I think you don't see, and people have asked us this about, hey, is this group growing or shrinking? Statistically and demographically, they're shrinking because the baby boomers are getting older and they're just, you know, like it's a declining group of people. It's not shrinking fast, but what they are doing, even though they're shrinking in numbers slightly, is they're becoming more desperate and they start to claw and scratch. And I think with each subsequent election from here on out, it's going to become more obvious what their real values are, right? Like I think with Trump, it just became so obvious. Like they had to make a deal with the devil to say, okay, we talked about how we were the values party and how we blasted Clinton for all of these things. And James Dobson wrote this letter.
Person.
Yeah, and like how we have to have moral presidents and how that character matters to us so
much. Integrity matters. I remember that. And I said it too back then.
Yeah, for sure.
How can this guy do this? He's supposed to be a leader of the country and he's having affairs. Come on.
Oh, I mean, it's just unbelievable. And
outrage.
And they're just pulling their hair out, you know, clutching their pearls. And then, and then Trump comes along and they say, well, okay, you got us.
But he's getting the job done.
Yeah, we really don't care as much as the bottom line, which is our own political and cultural influence here. And I think at the end of the day, I think it's going to become more and more obvious. I referred to this recently as kind of the, in Europe, I mean, you would know better than I would, but there is also a kind of a Christian nationalism that just doesn't have the evangelical language behind it. Like in the United States, we have this kind of evangelical language and culture. And so Robert Jeffress and Tony Perkins can disguise what they're doing with the language of conversionism and the Bible and that kind of thing. But say in the UK or in other places where they're having this kind of like fear of Muslims and loss of culture, there's a religious nationalism that connects national identity with religion, but in ways that are not so evangelical. It's just more like Christianity as culture, as identity, and it's just more obvious. And I think the United States is on the road to becoming more like that, where Christian is just kind of a signifier of cultural conservative. It's statistically, it's already becoming that more and more every year.
Yeah, the numbers are saying that they're going down. The ones who affiliate as nuns, they call them, isn't it? The nuns, when you say, what is your religious affiliation? None. And so that number is growing every year. We know that. Well, I wanted to go back to your point. You were talking about what their goals are, because you said that it's not necessarily about conversionism anymore. This is something that struck me. I've been going through Mark McVicker's book on Christian Reconstructionism. It's a survey of the life of R.J. Rush Dooney. It's absolutely fascinating. I don't know if you've come across it, but Mark McVicker. Called Christian Reconstruction. It's really about the life of Rush Dooney and his theology. It's really fascinating. And he makes the point that one of the things that Rush Dooney talked about back in, going back to the mid-50s and early 60s, he believed that evangelicalism had gotten it wrong with the language of conversionism. It wasn't working. The church was rotten from the inside out. And so that's a lot of his Christian Reconstructionism and what became Dominion theology basically was his effort to say, we've got to try a different approach. And I think one of the things that his teachings have impacted the Christian right, they don't necessarily quote guys like Rush Dooney and other Reconstructionists, but his thought is there. And I think that goes back to your point about it's not necessarily a linear line. You can't just point to one or two people and say, that guy is the one who started it all. These ideas have spread and morphed. They've made their way down into populist speech. This idea that America was a Christian nation, is it just part of the evangelical talking points? They don't know where it came from. They just think it's the truth.
That's right.
It's just, that's the way it is, man. Of course it's a Christian nation. It's always been that way. Everyone knows that.
That's right.
So it's worked. The rhetoric has worked. And one of the things Rush Dooney was upset about was later in his life, he would say, read people's books and articles and things. And he would say, they're using my ideas, but they're not quoting me. Yeah. You know, so he was upset because he was so controversial. That was part of the reason why, that because he had some pretty extreme views, and people would quote his ideas, and that infiltrated into the Christian right and other areas of Dominion theology and Christian nationalism, but he doesn't get credit for it. So you got to really know some of the language. It's hard to decipher some of this stuff. Well, I was going to ask you one last question. Why is it a uniquely American thing? Because you say in your book, it's about, it seems to be a uniquely American thing. Yes, there's nationalism in other parts of the world, but is it significant that Americans believe that we used to be a Christian nation? Is that somehow an important point to make?
Yeah, that's a good question. Let me clarify. I think you have examples of religious nationalism popping up all over the world right now. I mean, I think you'd be hard pressed to find a better example of religious nationalism than India right now, like where it's you see a similar kind of religious nationalism going on in Brazil, in pockets in Europe. I think connection with kind of like national heritage with kind of religious identity. The United States,
white supremacy.
And so I think in America you see, I think it's unique. It's not the only place where religious nationalism is going on. I think you see this kind of global emergence of populism in response to the advances of enlightenment and rational thinking and science and the diminishing of the place of kind of traditionalism. I think you see emergence of like populist responses, and Christian nationalism is a part of that. So that's where it fits in the global context, you know, taking back the country for kind of the traditional middle-class folk who feel like this is, you know, it's ruled by elites and we resent kind of the cultural kind of influence there. But I think in the United States, I think we have a couple of things that are unique in that we have this unique history that we were founded by, I mean, the narrative of our founding being like pilgrims and people who are fighting for religious freedom and people who were escaping religious tyranny so that they could found the city on a hill that God would, I'm trying to think of the name of the sermon. I don't know why it's escaping me. The John Winthrop's famous sermon, right? Like brotherly, I can't remember. It's escaping me off the top of my head. So you've got this unique kind of narrative of our history that is tied to people coming over, escaping from religious persecution, gaining religious freedom. And yet, even though we forget, places in Massachusetts Bay Colony were very religiously oppressive. I mean, we think of Roger Williams and the separation of church and state being kind of the better example. This idea of religious liberty, of our founding documents, it's built into kind of our constitution and our DNA. We have this kind of fascinating history in a very, very uniquely evangelical language to describe our national consciousness. And we've remained. So the other thing is the United States has remained among all developed nations, we've remained the most religious. I mean, we're a unicorn in that, even though you see similar trends in the United States to what happened in Europe in decades past, the United States compared to other Western nations is very, very religious. When people go to church, they pray, they identify, even though you see the rise of the nuns, we punch above our weight in terms of religiosity. And so I think because of that religiosity, I think Christian nationalism can have this kind of powerful grip on our consciousness, because to go against this idea that, like, well, we're a democracy and we're a secular democracy and we shouldn't, to say that for a devout Christian is almost like saying, well, you're telling me to put my faith in a box and you're telling me I shouldn't vote my values and I shouldn't live out my faith in public. And that feels weird to me. And I don't want to, I can imagine even Christians in the United States who are not Christian nationalists. And when you explain what it is to them, they would say, no, separation of church and state is a good thing. And people should be free to worship as they want to and that kind of thing. They would still have this kind of schizophrenic idea of like, well, but at the same time, I want to vote my conscience And I think the United States should reflect Christian priorities and values. So I think the United States is unique because we have this like powerful evangelical influence and this evangelical legacy in history. So we're not the only place where religious nationalism is taking off or is exercising kind of this like resurgence. Mm-hmm. But we do have kind of a unique opportunity in the United States for it to grab a foothold and still exercise more power than you think it would in a secular nation like ours.
Some disturbing trends. Well, I know I said that was my last question, but have you got time for one more?
Sure
thing. Okay. There was a quote that jumped out at me from your book, and you said that, quote, "Those who would impose Christianity on the public sphere are also committed to a specific social order," end quote. So what exactly would that social order look like if they had their way? If they do win, you said they're declining, but let's say they do win, what does this social order look like?
Right. You look at the very policies that they're trying to advocate now. It would be rolling back rights for gay and transgender Americans to enable persecution, or not persecution, but discrimination against them. Like, I don't want to hire you. I don't want to serve you in my restaurant. I don't want to
Bake a cake for your wedding.
I don't want to do all of these things. And so it would be in the name of religious freedom, right? Like, I'm going to live out my religious freedom to discriminate against these groups. And so the social order really is what we're describing there is a traditionalist, by that I mean patriarchal, heterosexual, nuclear family centric kind of order, where everybody knows their proper place and where the traditional kind of social arrangements of men and women and heterosexual being the standard, and all of these other kinds of alternatives to that being deviant, and if not outlawed, at least not being given special privileges or rights or anything like that. And so it would be sacralizing and institutionalizing a social order that would ultimately require us to go back on things that we've already decided. So, like, whether you like abortion or not, it's legal under the Supreme Court decision in 1970 under Roe v. Wade. And whether you like gay marriage or not, it's the law of the land under 2015, Obergefell v. Hodges, right? So you've got rights to certain groups that would have to be rolled back if Christian nationalists were able to have their way, which is, you know, denying the rights and privileges of these kind of minority populations. Does that make sense?
It's a chilling vision, really. And people have said it's something out of a Handmaid's Tale sort of thing. I don't know if it's that extreme. Or going back to a guy like Rush Dooney, his vision of, hey, we're going to have to execute people for violations of the law. That's what he said. Some of the more shocking stuff that his vision of a theonomy, hey, if you're disrespectful to your parents, we'll just drag you out in the square and stone you.
Right.
That's what they did in the Old Testament.
Think about this. And, you know, and we have already documented in studies that we've done this, my graduate students and Andrew and I and other people who are working on this. Christian nationalism is strongly associated with wanting capital punishment, so executing, you know, wrongdoers. Mm-hmm. It is the strongest predictor of gender traditionalism in the family, like you believe women ought to be in the home and not work and that kind of thing. Powerfully associated with, one of the strongest associated with outlawing gay marriage and or civil unions and all of those kinds of things, believing that transgender people shouldn't have the right to use the bathroom of their choice, all the, you know. And so I think it's undeniable that if a Christian nationalist agenda was to come to fruition with a Congress that backed it and the Supreme Court that backed it and a president that backed it, I think the social order would reflect, I think, the marginalization of a whole lot of minority people. Basically anybody who's not a male, heterosexual, white Christian.
Evangelical, yeah. Whatever, tick the boxes. Look at, for example, Capital Ministries, Ralph Drollinger. I've been doing a lot of reading about him. He's doing Bible studies in the Capitol every week.
And he's a
religious extremist who said some pretty horrific things about, he said the coronavirus was as a result of abortion and homosexuality, women, you know, belong in the home and the patriarchal narrative. Yet the Capitol Ministries have outposts not in something like 40 some states, capitals, but also in numerous countries around the world. Right. So this Christian nationalist message is not just an American thing, although it's maybe a uniquely American thing from some points of view, but people like Ralph Drollinger, people like the Fellowship, the Family, they're doing stuff worldwide, trying to advance this agenda. We don't know who they're talking to. We don't know what they're talking about. It's all in secret. It sounds like some bizarre conspiracy theory, you know, the Illuminati.
For sure, yeah.
But it's happening.
Yeah.
So I'm glad that you guys are getting the word out. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. I know you had to make a special trip into the campus and do this recording, but at least it bought you a little bit of peace and quiet away from the home.
Yeah.
So how can people get a hold of you? What's the best way to find you on social media?
Follow me on Twitter, @SoCofTheSacred, S-O-C of the Sacred, short for Sociology of the Sacred. So, follow me on Twitter. And if you go to my campus or my faculty webpage through the university, it'll have my email address on there, and feel free to reach out with questions. Yeah.
We can track you down somehow or another. And then how can people get a hold of your book? What's the best way to find it?
Well, so right now, because of COVID-19, the warehouse is actually shut down. The Oxford University Press warehouse is shut down. So you might be able to order a book on Amazon, but it'll be backlogged a little bit. You might have to wait. You can get it on Kindle right now. And from what I understand, it'll be on Audible soon. Mm-hmm. So that might be another route to do. But, you know, see whatever venue you can, or whatever medium you can get it on, Amazon.
Somehow or another, Amazon's your best bet. I got the Audible version of Catherine Stewart's book. So I was listening to that driving back and forth to work the other day. So that's a great way to go too. If you can't get it in a paperback copy, you might be able to get it on Kindle or Audible. So look for the book. So thank you so much, Sam. I appreciate your time. I will look forward to talking to you, hopefully, again.
That'd be great. Love to.